Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama has called for a new tax rule. Anyone who earns more than $1 million yearly must pay an income tax rate of at least 30%. The proposal, known as the Buffett Rule, is adding new fuel to the debate over fairness in our tax code and the need to encourage private investment. Joining me to talk about these issues, Alice Riblin of the Brookings Institution, Stephen Moore of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and David Leonhardt of the New York Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Jared, explain to us the background of this so-called Buffett Rule briefly and what you believe it could do.
Sure. Over the past few decades, Diane, a number of what you can call them loopholes or you can call them incentives have crept into the tax code, particularly affecting the income sources of the richest among us. Things like the money you make from capital gains, selling a stock that's appreciated. These kinds of income sources are now very favorably treated in the tax code. And that's why a guy like Warren Buffett, whose name this rule is named after, or more recently, we hear Mitt Romney in this context, are paying tax rates about 17% in Buffett's case, about 14% in Romney's case, even though their incomes are in the hundreds of millions. Meanwhile, people who earn what's called ordinary income, wage-based income, are taxed at what's called ordinary income rates, which get up to 35% for folks in the top of the scale. And so, as you mentioned in your introduction, this is a basic fairness issue. It turns out, actually, that the average tax rate among millionaires and billionaires is around 30%. It's just that this group of people whose incomes are coming from all these assets with all these loopholes get very special and favorable treatment. Now, you ask, what does it do? Well, one thing is it injects a big dose of fairness into a tax code that's grown terribly unfair. I think most people would agree with Mr. Buffett that the idea that his secretary pays a tax rate twice the rate of his is unfair. It also helps deal with our fiscal situation, which, of course, is pretty dire. The newspaper this morning, a good op-ed by Robert Samuelson, pointed out that the Buffett rule would raise something like $40 to $50 billion a year. So, you know, multiply that by 10 and you have the kind of budget numbers, you know, $400, $500 billion against the deficit. That would help a lot. It wouldn't solve everything by any stretch of the imagination. But let's not let the best be the enemy of the good here. So I think it's a good idea.
Alice Riblin, a good idea.
I think it's a good idea. And as Jared says, it's mainly a fairness idea. It makes clear that everybody has to contribute to this society, especially people who have benefited enormously from being part of the American economy. I don't think it goes nearly far enough. I would like to reform the whole tax code to make it fairer, a broader base, and lower rates. But it's a first step, and I am for it.
Stephen Moore, how do you see it?
I think it's probably about the worst thing we could possibly do for the economy. I think the idea of raising the capital gains tax to 30% and the dividend tax to 30% would make America a very unfavorable place to invest in. I think it would really have a devastating impact on jobs and investment in this country. And, you know, my major issue is how do we make America more competitive in a global economy, Diane, where we're competing with China and Japan and Germany and France and India for capital and jobs. And if you there's an old saying, if you tax something, you get less of it. This would be the biggest increase in tax on investment in the history of this country, and I think it would be really devastating. The other thing I want to just point out is this ruse that Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary is simply flatly untrue. Everyone knows it's untrue. The reason that it appears that Warren Buffett pays a lower tax than his secretary is because we're not counting the corporate income tax. And the company that Warren Buffett owns, Berkshire Hathaway, paid over $2 billion in taxes in 2009. I just looked up this data. He owns 30% of that company. So that was tax that was paid by him. If we did something like the Buffett rule, Jared, I'd say the only way it would even make any sense is to eliminate the corporate income tax entirely.
All right. David Leonhardt, how do you see the broader picture?
I'd say the broader picture is that over the last 30, 50 years, whatever long time frame you want to look at, we've had two different developments at the very top of the income distribution. One, the pre-tax incomes of people at the very top have gone up far more than they have for anyone else, far more than they have for the middle, far more than they have for the bottom.
Explain those pre-tax incomes.
So that's how much your employer is actually paying you before the government gets involved and starts taking your taxes. And the pre-tax earnings of people in the middle have gone up faster than inflation over the last 30 years, but not much faster than inflation. Whereas at the top, they've gone up hugely. They've doubled. They've tripled. And there are a lot of reasons for that. There's this notion of superstar economics in which we pay the very best people at things more than we used to, in part because there's a global marketplace. There's the fact that finance is a bigger part of the economy than it used to be. There's an argument that deregulation plays a role in all of this. Now, those trends, those pre-tax trends, have then been exacerbated by the tax rates. The tax rates on people at the top have gone down a lot. The tax rates of everyone else have gone down a little. And so you used to have people, the very richest people, paying 50, 60% of their total income. I'm not now talking about marginal tax rates. I'm talking about how much you actually pay in all federal taxes, including the corporate taxes that Steve was just talking about. And that's now down to something like a third of their income. And so that doesn't immediately answer what we should do here, because there's a philosophical argument that everyone should pay the exact same tax rate. But the fact is that if you look at which direction we've gone in the direction of people at the top making vastly more than they used to and paying much less of every dollar in tax than they used to.
Alice Rivlin, explain that marginal tax rate question.
The marginal tax is what you pay on the last few dollars that you earn. Everybody gets some exemptions, and then they begin paying at lower rates on their income. But people who make more money pay higher rates on the additional income, and that's called a marginal rate. And that a progressive tax is one where the marginal rate goes up as you earn more money or have more money coming in, you pay more.
How do you respond to Stephen Moore's argument that this would be the worst thing you could do to install the Buffett rule?
Oh, I think it is, with all due respect to Steve, pretty much nonsense. There isn't much evidence for it. We have had much higher taxes in the past on upper income people and on capital gains without any demonstrable bad effect. In the couple of decades after World War II, our taxes were much, much higher up into the 70 to 90% on top incomes. Those were high growth years. And more recently in the 1990s, before the Bush tax cuts, we also had high growth years. So I don't see any connection here within a reasonable range. I mean, nobody wants to go back to 90% tax rates, but within the reasonable range, I don't see a connection with growth.
Stephen Moore.
Well, look, I think the most important lesson of the last 30 years in terms of economics is that tax rates matter a lot. You know, Reagan came in when those rates were as high as Alice was talking about, 70% marginal tax rate on income. Reagan lowered the rates from 70 to 28%, and we had a 25-year boom, almost unprecedented in the history of this country. That's what my book, The End of Prosperity, is about. One interesting issue is that if you look at, let's just take this idea of having a 30% capital gains tax, which essentially is what the Buffett rule would do. Almost the data is almost 100% true on this, that you're actually above what we call the revenue maximizing rate. So if you have a capital gains tax rate of 30%, the federal government will actually lose revenue. That, in fact, the Congressional Budget Office, which Alice used to run, the Joint Tax Committee, all say that the revenue maximizing rate on capital gains is probably somewhere between 20 and 25%. So it doesn't make any sense to have a tax rate that actually loses revenue for the government.
David Leonhardt.
The problem with this argument is there is certainly a tax rate at which we would be discouraging economic activity and that would be hurting growth. And I don't think we know exactly what that tax rate is. I don't think there's any scientific way to know exactly what the number is. But the problem with the argument that this will be terrible for growth is the last few decades. George W. Bush cut taxes and promised a big boom, and instead we had a decade of the slowest economic growth since World War II. Bill Clinton raised taxes on the rich, and there were all these great forecasts of doom from Larry Kudlow and Newt Gingrich, and instead we had the fastest growth since the 1960s. You can even go back to the 1980s. The great Reagan boom began actually after Reagan increased taxes and took away some of his tax cuts. The tax increases obviously didn't cause those booms, but within this relatively narrow band where we are in this country, we're not talking about 90% marginal tax rates anymore. The evidence that these kind of tax movements are the dominant or even a large force driving growth, the problem is the last 30 years don't really support that.
At the same time, Jared Bernstein, you talked about raising 40 to 50 billion in revenues. We're not talking about reducing the deficit, are we? Aren't we talking simply about fairness?
I think we're talking about both. The fact is that we simply cannot achieve a sustainable fiscal path without more revenues in the mix. I mean, this is widely accepted. We can't get there through spending cuts alone.
Jared Bernstein, he's former economic policy advisor for Vice President Biden. Stay with us. And our first emailer, Ann in Fleming Island, Florida, asks that we please address the alternative minimum tax, how it affects taxpayers with very high incomes from investments. Atlas.
The alternative minimum tax is something we actually put in our tax code for similar reasons that we're talking about now, because some very high income people, a very small number actually, were paying no tax at all. And that seemed outrageous. So the alternative minimum tax was put in to make sure that everybody, even people who have large deductions, exemptions, et cetera, pays a minimum tax. Unfortunately, over the years, it wasn't indexed. It didn't go, the thresholds didn't go up with inflation. And so it now catches quite a lot of people. And it needs reform, but it would be expensive to reform it. So we have just kicked it down the road each year and let it be.
Stephen.
Well, this is one reason why I think the middle class might want to be afraid of this idea of the super, what we've called the Buffett rule, the super alternative minimum tax, because, you know, you're right, Alice, that this came into existence, was it 68 or 69, I think it was, and it was to impose a tax on a few hundred of the richest Americans that, that were not paying very much tax. And what that what it turned into was a tax that, that could soon affect 25 to 30 million people. So every time we impose these taxes on the super rich, they hit people who are not always rich. I want to get one statistic out, if I can, that I think is so important. If you look at the tax distribution today, and you all know this, that the richest 1% pay about 40% of the income tax. So that one out of 100 pay 40%. The richest 10% pay about 70% of the income tax. And the bottom 50% pay about 2.5% of the income tax. So it is a highly, highly progressive tax system as it is. And the question I'd ask, for example, Jared, who's one of the instigators of this idea, is do you want the top 1% to pay all the tax? I mean, it's such a highly progressive system already.
I don't want them to pay all the tax. I think it's important to recognize that they're actually not paying 40 or 70% of all the tax. They're paying federal income tax. So if you actually look at the full system of taxation, you find that the bottom 50% are paying a lot more in payroll taxes, for example, than they are in income taxes.
But we are talking about tax rates, not percentage.
Right. So that's the other thing. There are a lot of numbers floating around here. I'm glad you brought that up, Diane. What Steve is saying, it's not that the top 1% pay a 70 or a 40% tax rate. He's saying that's the share of all federal income taxes they pay. Their actual federal tax rate, the share of their income that the top 1% pays in taxes, is 30%, according to the CBO. Now, the problem is that you've got a lot of people out there who aren't paying that 30%. They're paying 15% for it. And that's because their income is coming from these other sources. And I very much disagree with Steve's point that somehow that you can just tack on the corporate tax rate, because I guarantee you Mitt Romney's not paying that corporate tax
rate.
Well, the thing to remember about people with very high incomes, yes, they pay a higher percentage of the tax, but they have a very high percentage of the total income. That's what we're talking about. And the percentage for the highest group, the top 1%, if you will, has gone up very, very fast and very much faster than the rest of us.
David.
The brief summary is that tax rates for the rich have fallen very rapidly over the last 30 years, but their pre-tax income has increased even more rapidly than their tax rates has fallen. So they're making more dollars. They're paying less of each dollar in taxes. When you combine the two, the total amount of federal income tax they pay has gone up because their income has gone up so rapidly.
Can I just say one thing about
sure.
that? I mean, that's the whole idea, as you know, to supply-side economics. If you lower tax rates, you'll get higher taxable income. And so one of the things we did in 1986, which a bill that passed with 97 votes in the Senate, we got rid of loopholes. We lowered the tax rate, and yeah, taxable income went up. But I think, David, that was partly a result of the fact that rates came down, so people have an incentive not to invest in loopholes, but to report their income.
So that's a great point that Stephen just made. But my view, and I think the view of most people listening to this show, most people who want the economy to work better for them, that is not what supply-side economics is about. What supply-side economics is about is if you do this, if you lower the tax rates on the richest people, you will create more jobs, more income, more earning opportunities for the broad middle
right.
class.
Yeah.
And that's the part, as David Leonhardt said earlier, hasn't happened.
Dave?
I think it's with this tax history, it's important to remember that we can't prove a general rule with one anecdote, right? So it is true that top incomes went up a lot after taxes were cut in the 80s. It's also true that top incomes soared after tax rates went up in the 90s. So if you were to look just at the 90s, you can say, wow, the best thing we could do to increase incomes at the top is to raise the tax rates of the rich because Bill Clinton did that and their income went up. That's, of course, not true, right? It's sort of one data point, and it's important to look at the whole
Alice.
Picture.
The big thing is incomes have gone up very rapidly at the very top. But I'm glad that Steve brought up the tax reform of 1986, because that was basically a good thing. It broadened the base. It got rid of not all but many of the loopholes and exemptions. We ought to do that again. We need a thorough reform of our income tax that makes it fairer and can keep the progressivity.
I think one thing to keep in mind here about the Buffett rule is you can make a very very good critique of it, that it makes the tax code even more complicated. We're talking about layers upon layers upon layers. And I understand people who support it would say, yeah, but we can't go out and just remake the whole tax code. But I do think if we're talking about a tax code that from an economist perspective, both liberal and conservative economists, you would want a tax code that doesn't have a Buffett rule, but instead is vastly simpler than the one we have.
See, this is my problem with... In my opinion, what Alice said is a contradiction. On the one hand, she said we should go back to the 1986 kind of rule of lowering tax rates, broadening the base. I completely agree with that, Alice, and I bet you and I could sit down and we could come up with something a lot better than we have right now. But that's completely inconsistent with the Buffett rule, which raises marginal tax rates and makes the tax system, I think, less pro-growth. I just don't think this is what the problem I have with what the president said. We want tax reform, but we want these higher tax rates. Well, that's a contradiction.
Look, everybody wants tax reform. We can all sit around a room and very quickly agree on it. But the problem is the tax reform creates winners and losers. And in a town like this, as I see heads nodding, in a town like this, it's going to be extremely hard to get there. In the meantime, we need some kind of a levy against this excessive income accumulation at the top. It's bad for the economy and it's bad for our fiscal position.
So you're saying even though we can't tackle the whole big thing, we need this one thing. Alice, would you agree?
I'm saying that, too. I'd go for the Buffett rule right now. It's a small fix, and it's a good thing. But I would sacrifice it in a minute when and if we get to reform the whole tax code.
Agreed. Here's part of the problem. In rooms like this, you can also often get quick agreement on fundamental tax reform, right? The idea is you put a smart conservative and a smart liberal in a room, and you can get fundamental tax reform.
I've got them all here.
Well, we figured everything in this room.
Here's who doesn't want tax reform: a large number of the American voters. And that's because if you ask them if they want tax reform, sure, that sounds great. But if you ask them, hey, do you want to lose your mortgage deduction? No, they don't want that. Do you want to lose the huge deduction for health care? No, they don't want that. They want to get rid of little tax deductions that almost no one pays. And so if you look at the polling here, you can make a really good argument that what the American people want is not fundamental tax reform. It's what economists want. And so you could say that a really good leader could go out and sell them on that. We don't have that leader right now anywhere in either party. But if you look at the polling, what the American people want, for better or worse, depending on your view, is not fundamental tax reform. They want higher taxes on rich people.
But do they? Has there been polling on the Buffett rule, Alice?
I don't know. There's certainly on the exact Buffett rule. There certainly has been polling on the attitude toward very rich people and the notion that they don't pay their fair share.
But
and that's what this is about.
Is this class warfare, Steve?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, look, the problem with this whole discussion is I'm the only one who's brought up the corporate income tax. And the corporate income tax is a second tier of tax on top of all these other taxes we're talking about. So, for example, when Jared says, well, these rich people like Warren Buffett are paying 17%, they're not paying 17%. They're paying 17%. But they don't get Warren Buffett doesn't get a penny of his money until Berkshire Hathaway paid 35% tax rate on the profits before he received them. So my point is we should either have a capital gains and dividend tax or we should have a corporate tax, but we shouldn't have both.
Steve, I mentioned the corporate tax rate before. Those numbers I gave on the percentage of each average dollar that people pay in taxes included the
That's
corporate
true.
Tax rate.
Right.
And so if you go back to the 60s and 70s, you see that very affluent people were paying 50, 60% of their income on average to the federal government. They're now down to about 30, 35. That's including the corporate tax rate. So I agree with Steve that some of this discussion of Romney's taxes has been exaggerated because it doesn't take into account the corporate tax rate. But even when you include the corporate tax rate, the tax rates of people at the very top have gone down dramatically.
All right. Here's an email from John in Cleveland. I don't buy the argument that taxing millionaires that earn on investments would hurt the economy. It said they get this tax cut to allow them to invest and create jobs. However, it's these same investors pushing corporations to make more profits. This, in turn, sends jobs overseas for cheaper labors. Tax them at a higher rate. This is just a smokescreen, Steve?
Yeah, I completely disagree with that. I think we are in a competitive world today, whether we like it or not, and American companies are competing with companies in China and Japan and Germany. If we raise our taxes on investment here, if we make it more expensive to invest here, at the margin, more investment will go abroad. I don't think any of you would disagree with that premise.
It's a perfectly plausible theory. What you have to do with every one of these economic theories is actually go into the data. And luckily, we've had so many changes in the capital gains tax rates over the years, it is a bit of a political football, that we can actually look in the data and see if it has had any of the kind of empirical effects that Steve would mention. And the fact is, it has not. It has simply not shown up. The emailer is exactly right. It has simply not shown up that when you lower the capital gains rate, you get an investment boom, or when you raise it, you get an investment bust. David made the point earlier, looking at the Clinton years versus the George W. Bush years. And
Clinton cut the capital gains tax.
What? Clinton, no, but I'm saying if you look at when Clinton cut the capital gains tax, and when you look at when Reagan's rate was higher than that, 28%, what you don't see are the investment effects or the job effects that you mentioned and that the caller very correctly pointed out just haven't shown up. What you do see is people rearranging their capital gains so that they can take advantage of the tax change.
Alice.
But let's come back to this tax reform that you say we all agree on in principle, and David says we'll never get. I think we will get it. The two deficit reduction commissions on which I served made very clear that there are two things you need to do to get the deficit under control. One is reform entitlements. The other is reform taxes and raise more revenue therefrom. And that includes the corporate tax. It includes getting our corporate tax rate down, but broadening the base, because it is true that we have a high rate compared to other countries.
Alice Rivlin at the Brookings Institution. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Russell. He's in Grapevine, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
I just had a question regarding how you're going to actually get to the uber rich. You know, they have teams of lawyers, accountants, who can reposture themselves according to any rules that you concoct. And specifically, say, for instance, John Kerry and Tarazza Hines actually funded part of the school down the street from my house on zero coupon municipal bond. So they get 8% for investing in the school construction. But then there's a group in Washington that says, well, they shouldn't be making $100 million a year. So now we're going to tax on their receipts from the interest on that. And who's going to fund the school next time? Who's going to fund the bridges, the roads?
David.
If you look at history, when you raise tax rates at the top, taxes do really go up on people who make a lot of money. Yes, there are loopholes. Yes, they can move around money in different ways. But that isn't the dominant thing. And so that if you look at if you go back to the 80s and you look at the big tax cut that Reagan put in place on people at the very top, that really did lower their tax rates. And then you look at the tax increase that Clinton put in place on people at the very top, much smaller than the cut Reagan put in, that really did increase their tax rates. So it's true there are loopholes that people use and there are exceptions, but they are the exception. And so that if you were to raise tax within the band we're talking about, if you were to raise taxes on people at the top, you really would raise their taxes.
Steve.
I guess we're just looking at a totally different set of data, because in the 1980s when Reagan cut tax rates, David, you know, when Reagan came into office, we had $500 billion of revenue. 10 years later, when he left office, we had $1 trillion. Now, not all of that was income tax revenues. A lot of it was payroll tax revenues, other taxes. But the point of lowering tax rates is to grow the economy. The economy did grow. We created 16 million jobs in the 80s, and that boom went into the 90s. You're right, David. Bill Clinton did raise income tax rates, but he also cut the capital gains rate. And Jared, as you know, after 1997, when we cut the capital gains rate, the revenues from the capital gains tax doubled. So every time we've cut the capital gains rate, we've gotten more revenue. And every time we've raised the rate, we've gotten less revenue.
I don't disagree with that point. And it's exactly what I said before. People, and they've got a lot of tax lawyers who help them figure this out, move their capital gains rates around to take advantage of changes like that. The question that I think Steve doesn't ever go far enough in is in actually looking at the bottom line for the American middle class, which is, Do we actually help the broad, middle, low-income people through these supply-side trickle-down changes? We know that the money trickles up. We've already talked about that. What we don't know is whether it trickles down. And in fact, the evidence is that it simply hasn't done so. The more we pursue the trickle-down kind of ideas that Steve is espousing, the worst outcomes we get on jobs and incomes.
The caller's specific question wasn't about economic growth, right? Reagan cut taxes and the economy grew. Clinton raised taxes and the economy grew. The caller's concern is that if you raise taxes on affluent people, they simply get around it. And when you look at any numbers, the Congressional Budget Office numbers, what you see is that when Clinton came into office, the tax rates on people at the top were below 30%. Talking about total federal average tax on the top 1%, he took them up to more like 34 or 35%. So when you put a tax increase in place on affluent people, it really does affect them.
Alice. I thought the caller was worried about who was going to fund the schools when affluent people didn't have as much to give to charity. I think affluent people will give to charity anyway. Warren Buffett certainly does. I'd rather have the schools funded the way they're supposed to be, through taxes at the local level.
Alice Rivlin, she's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Short break now, and when we come back, more of your calls, your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Understanding the Fifth Amendment. For our Constitution Today series, we consider pleading the Fifth, plus eminent domain and efforts to balance individual property rights with the public good. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. An email from Dwayne in Charlevoix, Michigan. How do we become more competitive in a global economy? We pay our workers about $1 a day, reduce health care even more, make our workers live in substandard dorms and apartments, make sure that the lobbyists make the rules so that we are more like China, Southwest Asia, etc. Just look at the news today, says Dwayne. I love Apple, but I think it's appalling that Apple is competitive because many in China have to suffer under low wages, endless hours, and less than fair working living conditions. Buffett is right, and it's a start. If we don't follow his lead soon, we will not be like Europe, but like China. And that's the question. Is the Buffett rule a start? Would it make sense, David Leonhardt?
Well, I'll leave that to the other three folks here to decide whether it would really make sense. But I guess the one thing I would say is that a lot of these things that we're worried about with China, I think we worry too much about. There was just a poll about what country has the strongest economy in the world, and more Americans pick China than pick the United States. That's remarkable. We're so much richer than China. If you go to China, all they talk about there is how they want to learn how to innovate the way we're learning. And I agree China is an economic threat in some ways. But it's worth remembering that we don't want dollar-a-day jobs. We don't have dollar-a-day jobs. And all China wants to do is make its economy more like our economy. And so what we want to do is keep pushing further and further ahead and not get too wrapped up in looking behind us.
I totally agree with that. And you're already seeing in China, fortunately, strikes of workers and people protesting the very conditions that shock the caller. But what we need to do is the opposite of what he is suggesting we might do. We need to raise wages so that people have more money to buy things. And we need to invest in people and training and education to get more skill. And we need to invest in our infrastructure. We need to do that at the same time we're bringing down our long-term debt or getting it under control. That's not impossible, but it's a tall order, and we haven't gotten a political system that's able to deal with that right now.
And is the Buffett rule a start?
You know, I think the Buffett rule isn't all that, doesn't have a ton of impact on these issues that we're talking about, which in many ways are the greater, more important issues for the prosperity of the country and the broad middle class in terms of jobs, in terms of expanding industries, in terms of investment in people's skills and investment in expanding sectors. We spend much too much of our time obsessing over these tax changes. And as David said very correctly, I think he made an important point earlier, that if you actually look at the economic growth record, it's far, far, far less sensitive to these tweaks in the tax code than we all get obsessed about. If you look at the historical record, if you cut taxes for rich people, they do a lot better. If you lower taxes, if you raise taxes for rich people, yeah, you earn more revenue for the Treasury. Now, that's actually important, and that's why I think Alice and I are supportive of the Buffett rule, because like I said at the beginning, it brings in $40 to $50 billion a year, and if you want to do more investment, and if you want to do more education, if you want to have a healthier economy, an amply funded government, that's what you need.
All right, to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Good morning. I have just a comment and a question, and it really goes back to the beginning of your program.
Sure.
First of all, loops is kind of a loaded term, frankly. These are deductions that were enacted by the Congress or taxes that were enacted by the Congress. People who use them legitimately, and they're not loopholes in any sense that normal people understand that word. My second question is, someone said that the very wealthy pay an average effective tax rate of about 30%. What is the average effective tax rate middle class? Does anybody have any information?
It's about 15%, and that's why I think the Buffett rule is very deceptive. I mean, a lot of Americans, Diane, think that rich people pay a lower tax rate than middle-income plumbers and secretaries, and it's just flatly not true. And, you know, David, I'm disappointed in the media that, you know, for example, why haven't people in the media asked Warren Buffett to release his tax form and his secretary so we actually know how much he pays and she pays?
I'll respond briefly. This is Jared. I mean, it's actually 14% for the middle class, and you know, I agree that with what Steve just said. I think the problem isn't that remember, the average middle class income is around $50,000. So you're talking about a guy whose income is we're talking about Romney now, whose income is somewhere in the $200 million range, paying the same effective tax rate as someone who's got about $50,000. That's the fairness issue right there.
But what Steve says is effective tax rate.
The average rate on all their income.
I'm talking about, the effective rate. This is what Buffett and Romney said. Our effective rate, meaning If you take what they pay as a share of their income, it's 14, 15, 16%, about the same as a middle-class family.
And that's where Steve disagrees.
I disagree because that doesn't include the corporate tax. That's why the CBO data is important because it's saying the middle class.
The CBO includes the corporate tax.
That's the 30% rate. That's double what a middle-class family
pays. Romney does not pay the corporate
tax rate
because his income is passed through. Any corporate income he gets is passed through to his individual tax cut.
Right.
I mean, and that's why he completely evades the corporate rate.
David.
I think if we had the absolute perfect look at these numbers, we would include the corporate tax rate, and I think we would also include state and local taxes. I mean, what we care about at the end of the day are how much money do people have to spend on themselves when it's all said and done. And so when you include the corporate tax rate is vastly progressive. It falls overwhelmingly on affluent people. And state and local taxes are quite regressive. They fall largely on people in the middle. And so still what you're left with, I think, is a similar picture, which is there are exceptions, but by and large, the typical affluent person pays a higher tax rate than the typical middle-class person, but the typical affluent person pays a much lower tax rate than the typical affluent person did 30 years ago.
Alice.
I agree with the caller that loopholes is a bad word, but there are some features of our tax code that are quite unfair. The way that hedge fund managers are compensated, for example, it's called carried interest, and it isn't really very defensible.
Explain it.
Well, the people whose money they manage pay fees, right? But those fees that are not counted as ordinary income for reasons that escape me, they are taxed at the same rate as capital gains. And so if you're a successful hedge fund, so 15%. That's not illegal. These people aren't doing anything that they shouldn't. It's actually in the tax code, but it's ridiculous. It shouldn't be there. It's unfair because that's income that those people are earning, and it ought to be taxed like
it. I'm going to call it a loophole, with apologies to the caller.
All right, let's go to Hedgeville, West Virginia. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane. I emailed you this to hand out to your advisors there, but I would like to see the tax code changed on the capital gains to promote investment and discourage the speculation that caused things like our last recession that we're still in. I would like to see them increase the tax on capital gains in the real short term up to 50% for less than 30 days. And for people that keep their money invested for 10 years, the first $1 million would be free of capital gains and 10% on everything else, and it would be at 5 years, 10% on capital gains. So we could get people to invest for the long term and stop the speculation that has hurt everyone, both in gas prices as well as house prices, and watching your 401k drop by 50% when the housing bubble dropped.
What do you think of that, Steve?
It's an interesting idea. I think the reason people should be concerned about capital gains is this really is kind of the rocket fuel for our economy. I mean, this high-risk capital that people put in venture capital funds and so on that often is used to start small businesses. And sometimes those small businesses become large businesses. And there's a couple reasons we have a lower rate on capital gains right now. One is that the tax system makes you pay tax on your capital gains, but you don't get to deduct your capital losses. So that's a bit unfair. And the second thing is when you talk about an investment that is 10 or 15 years, we don't allow you to index your capital gains for inflation. If we're going to have a higher rate of tax on capital gains, then we should probably allow those capital gains to be indexed for inflation over 10 or 15 years.
I'm also worried about how often small business become large business and how many small business owners go down.
Oh, yeah. Look, two-thirds of small businesses fail, three-quarters of them.
Exactly.
But you're looking for the diamond in the rough that's going to be the next Staples or Home Depot.
Just a factual point. People do get deduct capital losses from their income. Look, It was interesting to me that the caller was from Hedgeville. I thought this was perhaps perhaps a town of hedge fund managers. The issue that I think the caller raises well, and Alice alluded to it a second ago, one of the problems we have, and it does lead to excessive speculation, is when we have all these, in respect to our previous caller, I'll avoid the term loopholes, when we have all this special preferential treatment in the tax code, you don't get more growth, you don't get more investment, you don't get more jobs. What you get is a lot of, unless you want to count jobs for tax lawyers, what you get is a lot of people rearranging their income in order to get the best deal from the tax code. We see this all the time. By the way, if you ever want to have trouble falling asleep, pour through Mitt Romney's tax returns, and you'll see lots of there's Cayman Island accounts, there's Swiss accounts, you'll see lots of tax planning. As someone said earlier, not against the law, but that kind of speculation doesn't really help economic growth. It just helps enrich those through those preferential treatments.
Alice. I agree with that, and I think we ought to be talking about how you simplify the tax code, make it less welfare for lawyers and accountants, and also a lower rate with a broader base. But if we want to grow the economy, we shouldn't be so preoccupied with the tax rates. We need to do much more important things than fiddling around with the tax code. We need to invest. We need to do infrastructure. We need to do skills. All of those things are more important than fiddling with the tax code.
Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The question is, we've had lots of talk, good explanations, good opinions. Is anything going to get done or changed?
This is what the election's going to be about.
Soon?
This election is going to be about this very issue we've been talking about for the last hour.
That's exactly right. Yeah, Congress is not going to do this year. There's no chance of it. And so what we're going to get to at the end of this year is a situation in which we have two really important things. One, we have an election. That's the more important. And two, we have all these different things in the tax code expiring, including the Bush tax cuts. And so you're going to get to a situation in which the status quo probably can't continue when you combine the fact that we have this deficit with all these expiring things. And we're going to have to wake up after Election Day and figure out which party is in better shape to try to make things happen. The odds are neither party is going to be able to do precisely what it wants.
Alice.
That's the point. No matter who wins the election at the presidential or the congressional level, the big things we're talking about having to do, reforming the entitlements, reforming the tax code, raising more revenue, bending the cost curve on health, those things are going to take bipartisan cooperation. We've got several blueprints for doing that, Simpson-Bowles, Domenici, Rivlin, you name it. They were all bipartisan. It can be done, but it's not going to be done as long as the two parties are just sniping at each other.
Look, this year, in this election year, with all the dynamics that are going on, what we've been talking about for the last hour, supply-side trickle-down economics is on trial. And I believe it will be found guilty. And I think that's going to be a positive thing for our economy going forward.
And I'd make the point that this election is going to be about these issues we've talked about. I'm not sure they can be dealt with in a bipartisan way because the divide is so large. The left wants the tax code to be emphasizing fairness, and the right wants it emphasizing growth and jobs.
Alice?
I think bipartisan solutions are possible. I think the Simpson-Bowles and Domenici Rivlin commissions proved that.
Right.
We can. We almost got there with the super committee in the fall.
And what happened, Alice?
Well, it fell apart because of all the reasons we've been talking about. There was no cooperation. There was no leadership. There was more willingness to blame each other than to get the problem solved. But we must solve the problem. And unlike Steve, I believe it has to be a bipartisan solution.
David. And even more important, John Boehner and Barack Obama essentially got there. They all but had a deal on it wouldn't have solved all the problems, but they had a really significant deal on this stuff. In the end, there were a couple of little things that they didn't get to. Well, it depends which side you listen to, because these were not public negotiations. But the main thing is that the Republicans in the House weren't willing to go along with as much new revenue, new tax revenue, as Boehner was. And so they didn't support the deal, and it fell apart. But if you look at all these different models, Simpson-Bowles, Domenici-Rivlin, I would add Obama-Boehner, to the list. Right. There is a roadmap. And so I do think you can make an optimistic case. I'm always happy to make the pessimistic case on what's going to happen here. But I do think you can make an optimistic case that in the next several years, we will get some kind of bipartisan budget deal.
We mustn't, and I think that Steve just put it on, and I disagree, we mustn't pose growth and fairness as alternatives. We can either have growth or we can even have fairness, or we can have fairness. We must construct an economy, and whether it's tax code, investment, education policy, you name it, it must be growth with fairness. Right now, we've had for decades growth absent fairness. And I think the combination of those two has to be the goal of public
policy. Steve, last word.
The last two or three years have been the worst three or four years for the middle class in the last 50 years. And in fact, the share of taxes and the share of income going to the rich have fallen dramatically in the last 3 years. So I think we need to put growth first and fairness will come next.
Stephen Moore, a member of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution, Jared Bernstein, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, former chief economist and economic policy advisor for Vice President Biden, and David Leonhardt, Washington Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and